Good morning and welcome to Midpoint, your mid-morning, midweek source for news and public affairs with a local perspective. I'm your host, Shelley Reback, and today we are grateful to have Lamar running our soundboard and Frank on the phones for us. If you want to join in our conversation, as always, you can call us once the show starts at 813-239-9663, email us your comments at dj@wmnf.org, or text us at 813-433-0885. Today, we are going to shed some light on some of the dark doings of the largest utility company in Florida, Florida Power and Light. FPL is again trying to hamstring the growth of solar power in the Sunshine State by promoting legislation to gut net metering, which is a policy that lets Florida homeowners and businesses offset their costs of installing solar panels on their property by sending their excess power generated by their solar system back into the electrical grid and selling that excess power back to the utility company. This policy benefits people who have invested in solar power at their homes and businesses. It encourages the growth of more solar power, and that encourages the growth of the solar industry and all the green jobs that go with it. It sounds like a win-win for Florida, the Sunshine State, right? No, not so fast. Power companies all around the country are feeling pressured by the rise of renewable energy. Rooftop solar may be critical to fighting climate change, but it is a threat to the traditional utility business model. Electric companies like FPL make their money off of the things that they build, like large power plants and the electric lines that bring that energy to customers. They don't make any money off solar power generated from rooftops. So, for the last 10 years or so of the growth in solar energy generation, FPL has been trying to put the brakes on it. In 2016, they backed a failed ballot amendment that would have allowed regulators to impose fees and other barriers to rooftop solar installation. And because promoting legislation is a lot easier than winning a ballot amendment, we are now learning more and more every day about FPL's efforts to sway elections in Florida to favor Republicans and maintain their control of the legislature and its ability to make laws in FPL's favor. Here's one example of how FPL influences energy policy in Florida. We know from reporting by the Miami Herald that FPL's lobbyists wrote the bill that guts net metering. Recently disclosed internal emails reveal that the lobbyist provided the proposed bill to State Senator Jennifer Bradley. 2 days later, FPL's parent company contributed $10,000 to Bradley's political committee. A month later, Bradley filed a bill that was almost identical to the one FPL gave her, and another lawmaker introduced the same bill in the House. Bradley denies that the donation was related to the bill, and FPL denies that they expected any favors in exchange for their donation. It's also been reported by the Orlando Sentinel and others that FPL and its parent company, NextEra, worked with dark money political committees to help secure continued Republican control of the state Senate in the 2020 election. FPL denies any wrongdoing, but a Florida state attorney is investigating. Just yesterday, the bill to hamstring net metering was introduced in the state Senate Committee on Regulated Industries. My guest on the program today will fill us in on the status of this bill and where it goes from here and what we can expect for the future of solar power and green jobs in Florida and the Tampa Bay region. My guest is Susan Glickman, Florida Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. A consultant and lobbyist in Tallahassee has been closely following this issue. Welcome, Susan. You with us?
Hi, Ellen. Good morning.
Good morning. Tell us, what is happening in Tallahassee with the net metering legislative proposal and clean energy in general?
Great. Well, let me first say, appreciate being on this morning. It's a little colder up here than in Tampa. And the first thing I wanted to clarify is that, as you know, I've been working with the Southern Alliance Clergy for a long, long time. And I'm now the director of the Florida Clinicians for Climate Action. So I'm still an ally with the Southern Alliance Clean Energy. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Florida Clinicians for
Climate Action. That's
Climate Action. Okay, that's your new role.
That's right. And doctors, nurses, pharmacists, other health professionals that are concerned about the health impact of climate change, and in this case, the health benefits that solar power offers. So we can certainly dig in, and I was at the meeting yesterday in person. So looking forward to kind of filling you and all the listeners in. This is really serious, Shelley. The net metering rule, which was established in 2008, is the really only good piece of solar policy that we have in Florida. And what it does is it requires the utilities to pay you a fair price for the energy that you create, you know, generate on your roof. And what they're doing is trying to change that so they would pay a lower price, which they call avoided cost. So right now, they have to credit you a retail rate, what you produce on your roof, which is what you would pay. And what they want to do is to reduce that down, and it's a phrase they use in utility called avoided cost. It originally was conceived to be avoiding the cost of the next increment of power, which one could argue might be that new gas plant that Tampa Electric built, right? The next increment of power, and not some sort of depreciated, you know, power plant late at night somewhere. But what they would tell you now is that their avoided cost for avoiding this energy would be about 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour versus 10 or 11 cents, which would be a more of a retail rate. So you can see where it changes the economics of getting solar, and the payback period, you know, might go from 7 years to 15 years. So it's going to really hurt the solar market. And yesterday in the committee meeting at the Senate Regulated Industries Committee, we heard a number of solar installers, developers, one right after another, just say this would really, really kill their business. They would be cutting their workforce in half or by two-thirds. And so there's strong concerns about, you know, changing this net metering rule.
Well, to be fair, though, doesn't FPL take the position now that they need some remuneration or some kickback on the energy generated by solar rooftop installations because they supply the grid and they make it useful? Isn't that their current position now, that that's their rationale for why they need this adjustment in net metering?
Yes, it certainly is a rationale that people make. And at, you know, approximately 2.3% of our energy being solar, you know, in Florida, we're about 75% reliant on fossil methane gas, which primarily is frack. So the life cycle emissions on that of a fracked gas power plant can be as bad as a coal-fired power plant. So the answer is yes. But guess who pays for the grid all along the process? The ratepayers do.
Yeah, the consumers, so right?
That's correct. The customers are paying for it. And in there was recently a number of rate increases for all the investor-owned utilities. Those are privately held companies like Tampa Electric, Duke, and Florida Power and Light. And they did negotiate, both Duke and Florida Power and Light, a minimum billing ability, which it means that they, you know, sort of manage that process. So number one, if we got to 10% of our need being met with solar, then we really do need to look at how you make that all equitable and fair. But at the very low amount of you know, sort of solar deployment that Florida has at this time, it's really premature and is more likely to just choke solar off altogether while it's really in its infancy.
Yeah, and given our needs in terms of addressing climate change and the particular dangers in the state of Florida to the consequences of climate change, you would think that from a political policy perspective that our state legislature would want to do whatever they could to encourage that we get up to at least 10% renewable energy generation. Wouldn't you think that?
At the very least, we really need to be moving toward 100% clean energy in the, 2030, 2035, 2040. In the Tampa Bay region, our Tampa Bay Science Advisory Panel has done projections back in 2015, and they were updated again in 2019. You know, we are in for 2.5 to 3.5 feet of sea level rise by mid-century, 2050, 2060. So this is all hands on deck, and we're starting to see the Florida legislature talk about resilience and put significant dollars into adaptation. So that's adapting to the climate impacts that are already baked into the pipeline. But if you walked into your bathroom and your sink is overflowing, you're not just going to put towels on the floor and mop the wet floor up. You're going to turn the faucet off, right?
Right.
We are not turning the faucet. We are not doing anything from a policy point of view. And that's why I said the current net metering rule is the only decent piece of solar policy that Florida has. And all it does is require the utilities to pay you a fair price for the energy that you create on your roof. And so in this the timing that we're at, not only did all three investor-owned utilities get significant rate increases just recently in the last number of months, they've also are passing on, and this is really important, additional costs for gas. So the utilities have made a bet. Tampa Electric did this when they, instead of moving to clean energy, wanted to build a new gas plant to replace a coal unit. They are passing on the additional cost for gas. So as you mentioned earlier, Shelley, they make a rate of return on capital expenditures, but fuel is just a pass-through. They don't make money on it, but they do pass it on. So for instance, Tampa Electric in 2020 did get 78 additional millions of dollars, in 2021. They just filed and then quickly withdrew another application for another $273 million. Now, I don't want to overload people with too many numbers, but Tampa Electric is 90% reliant on gas right now. So gas prices go up. So in 2020, they got $78 million. And I'm sure they'll reapply again, but they're asking for another $273 million was the application.
Now,
Florida Power and Light got $1,111,000,000 in 2021 in two different proceedings for additional costs for gas. And Duke is somewhat similar. They got about $250 million, and they've got another request for $314 million. So they're very happy to go in and charge people additional significant dollars for the additional cost of gas. And so it seems incredibly disingenuous for them to get up and raise all these concerns about how much money they're paying to buy solar from people. In the entire state of Florida in 2020, all the investor-owned utilities, all the municipal utilities, and all the rural electric cooperatives was less than $1.5 million. Really, Tampa Electric put out $43,000 in the entire in 2020 to pay customers. Duke was $117,000, and Florida Power and Light was $65,000. So it's a very, very tiny amount of money that's going to solar customers. It's an enormous amount of money that just went to rate increases. And generally speaking, the rate increases are from building power plants.
Right. And didn't we pay for some nuclear power plants that will never be built? Didn't we also pay for that?
Yeah. So in both Florida Power and Light and Duke territory, back in 2006, they passed a law that allowed people to charge, the utilities to charge in advance for new nuclear plants. And in the case of Duke, The plants never got built. They started to charge people to build a new nuclear power plant in Easy County. It was so expensive when they shut down that proposal. The price was about $25 billion.
And we'll never see that money back, I'm sure.
Never see any of that money. It was literally more than $1 billion.
All right. Let me tell our listeners that you're listening to Midpoint with Shelley Reback on WMNF Radio 88.5 and streaming at WMNF.org. And my guest today is Susan Glickman, the director of the Florida Clinicians for Climate Action, who is currently up in Tallahassee lobbying for clean energy and keeping us informed of the legislative developments on that front. If you have questions for Susan or comments on this issue, please give us a call at 813-239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. So, Susan, tell us what happened at the hearing yesterday where this net metering proposal by Florida Power and Light was presented in the Committee on Regulated Industries. And also, we have at least two senators on that committee from the Tampa Bay area, don't we? We have Joe Gruters, who's a Republican from Sarasota, and we have Daryl Roussan from St. Petersburg. And I'd like to know what their positions are on this or how they participated in the hearing.
Yes. Both of the senators, those senators did vote yay on the bill, which passed the Regulated Industries Committee, 6 yeas to 2 nays. I do know that Senator Roussan, who is from St. Petersburg, raised some questions. He did say that he has been getting a lot more calls opposing these changes to the net metering rule. He was concerned, and I know I shared some of the numbers. You know, there's an old phrase that people use for years and years, and I've been going into the state capitol for longer than I care to admit, but about 30 years. And people always used to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So when, you know, the entire state of Florida has put out, you know, less than $1.5 million for customers, you know, it's not broke, and we're not at that you know, sort of level of deployment.
So Daryl Roussan, the Democrat on the committee, voted in favor of Florida Power and Light's.
He did vote, and what he said was that he was going to vote to move it out the committee, but if they didn't sort of make some changes, that he was going to oppose it on the floor. So in the Senate side, it has two more committees, which is Community Affairs and then the Rules Committee. So Community Affairs will really be the only next substance stop. Senator Roussan is not on that committee. Ed Cooper, who is from Clearwater, a Republican for Clearwater, he also raised some concerns and said he is on Community Affairs Committee and would be looking for some changes. So Senator Roussan did throw up the suggestion that they should study this, which is actually what they should do. In other states, like somewhat recently in South Carolina, there was a big analysis about this to figure out, you know, what is the fair, you know, sort of a price or cost that people should be contributing and at what point. So it's certainly not now at this, you know, minimal, you know, level of deployment in Florida. So two more stops in the Senate.
So voters in the Tampa Bay area, if they are concerned about this, their next stop in terms of their activism on this would be to contact Ed Cooper, who's their representative on the Community Affairs Committee. Is that right?
Yeah, it's Senator Ed Cooper, who is from Clearwater, and also Senator Janet Cruz is on that committee, on Community Affairs. She wasn't on the first committee where it stopped, but Senator Cooper was on both.
Okay.
From a Tampa Bay point of view, it would be Janet Cruz and then Ed Cooper.
Okay. Janet Cruz and Ed Hooper are your local representatives on this issue in the next committee hearing on net metering. We have an email from Rhonda here, one of our listeners, who says, one of the speakers at yesterday's Senate hearing said there are lots of crossover costs by FPL to seniors and low-income and residents in general, favoring big commercial customers, and that this is nothing by comparison.
Yeah, what she's referring to was Bradley Marshall from Earth Justice spoke, and that organization had represented a number of sort of frontline community organizations in the recent rape case. So a lot of what happens, people don't realize that there are multiple different rates. So industrial and commercial customers negotiate in rate settlements for a lower rate, and residential customers pay a higher rate. So that would be considered a cross-subsidization, right? The people who are paying the lower rate are being subsidized. So what he was basically doing is poking holes in the argument that there is a kind of a genuine concern about a cross-subsidization. And this is the argument that's being made essentially by the utilities, that somehow people without solar are subsidizing people with solar because they get that retail rate, and that somehow the other customers are paying for the grid and the solar customers aren't. It's just not true, because you have a minimum bill and you're not always, you're not off the grid. So if you are putting energy onto the grid when it's bright and sunny and it's more than I'm using, then the utility is selling it to the neighbors, right?
Right.
At a retail rate. But if but you're still buying energy at night off the grid. So it's really a feigned argument. And then what Bradley Marshall was saying, which are obviously legitimate, important points, is that there's cross-subsidization going on all the time.
Yeah.
You know, some people are winter residents and they're not even here,
right,
you know, for many months at a time. So this idea, they're trying to do what we see a lot in politics, which is to be divisive and use certain words, and a lot of people don't know what cross-subsidization means. So it sounds like a terrible thing. Cross-subsidization happens all the time.
Yeah.
And if they were concerned about that, you know, we wouldn't be negotiating for, you know, residential customers, like most of the people listening, to subsidize industrial customers and large commercial customers. But that happens every single day.
And we're, again, losing sight of the policy advantages here of encouraging more people to generate their power through renewable energy sources. I mean, we keep losing sight of that, despite the fact that so many municipalities lately are putting forward these aspirational goals of being like zero carbon neutral, or being carbon neutral or zero, you know, putting carbon into the air by a certain date. And yet, even though these municipalities grant monopolies to these utility companies, we're seeing that the utility companies are attempting to make policies that are not consistent with the goals of the municipalities that granted them that monopoly.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I have been working on climate change and energy issues now for two decades. I mean, we are past 400 and 15 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. And I recognize that maybe some of the leaders in Tallahassee don't want to hear that. They're putting hundreds of millions of dollars a year into adaptation, adapting to the climate impact from the pipeline. But we're not doing anything to reduce. And we don't have that many tools in our toolbox. So the first thing you want to do is be more efficient. So out of 52 utilities nationwide, Tampa Electric is 46. Out of 52, Duke is 48, and Florida Power and Light, 51 out of 52. Becoming more efficient is the cheapest and fastest and cleanest way to meet our energy needs. And you don't want to put solar on an inefficient building. So if you want to do something to really reduce emissions, we need to go whole hog with efficiency, and we don't do that, right?
Right.
And then you put up solar. And now solar has dropped 90% in the last decade, and that's part of what's going on here. So in the entire state of Florida, there are only 90,000 net metered systems. Those are customer-owned renewables. And it's such, I threw out the numbers earlier, so I won't do it again. It's pretty minimal what they're paying. So we have to do efficiency. We have to do solar. And frankly, we're not doing a very good job at either one of those unless you don't take the climate crisis seriously.
Let me ask you, Bubba, one of our regular listeners, wants to know, what do you think about the municipal-owned utilities like Lakeland and Gainesville? Are they doing any better? Bubba thinks those companies are more accountable to the people than FPL.
They're actually not, unfortunately. That's exactly right, and that's what they should. Places like Orlando, for instance, where you have a mayor and they've committed to 100% clean energy. But unfortunately, a year ago, the Orlando Utility Commission passed an integrated resource plan, and they locked in 2 decades of fossil gas. They shut down 2 coal units. And they never sort of modeled or ran the numbers for what it would be to go from coal to clean. And I think what you're seeing here is you're seeing an industry. Years ago, I used to do tobacco policy, and some of what we see was similar to what the tobacco industry. They have a product and they want to sell it. And if you want to sell gas, you lock in customers for decades. And that's what happened in Orlando, and it was incredibly disappointing to have a muni who is supposed to have their interests be the citizens. They spent $200,000 on a National Renewable Energy Lab study that said they could get almost 400 megawatts of rooftop solar conservatively from a economic point of view, 370 megawatts. And then they put 60 in the model. They ignored their own study because somebody wanted to lock in gas. The same thing up at the University of Florida right now. On June 10th, the University of Florida Board of Trustees voted to pursue putting a 32-megawatt gas plant on the campus. I mean, to me, I work with health professionals at Florida's Clinicians for Climate Action. Nobody wants to breathe the nitrous oxides and nitrous dioxide coming out of the gas plant. Students and faculty and patients at the UF Health Center. I mean, it's really, really short-sighted. So why would you lock in 50 years of gas? I mean,
right?
If you hammer everything you see is a nail. So we see the influence of these industries everywhere pushing to lock in these products.
Well, Susan, that's a great segue to what I want to talk about next, which is the politics and the political activities of Florida Power and Light that they are engaging in to try to create the political atmosphere that allows them to have these decisions be made. I want to tell our listeners that they're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Radio 88.5 and WMNF.org. And my guest is Susan Glickman, who is the Florida Director of Clinicians for Climate Action. And we are talking about the efforts of Florida Power and Light, which is Florida's biggest utility company, to influence legislation against solar power and clean energy, and to perhaps, has been reported, perhaps correctly, influence local elections to preserve a Republican majority in the Florida legislature. And if you'd like to join our conversation, please call 813-239-9663, email us at dj@wmnf.org, or text us at 813-433-0885. So, Susan, can we talk for a minute about this Miami candidate scheme and Florida Power and Light's possible role in it? Let me give a brief summary. As has been reported, lawyers for a dark money group run by a prominent Republican operative asked a Miami court judge Monday to block the release of bank records that would disclose its donors, arguing that the release of such information would violate the donors' constitutional rights and could chill their speech across the political spectrum. The bank records were obtained by investigators who are examining potential election and campaign finance law violations stemming from a 2020 Miami-Dade election scheme in which Republican consultant and former state senator Frank Artiles has been indicted for recruiting and paying an auto parts dealer, Alexis Pedro Rodriguez, who shared the same surname as the Democratic incumbent and who, investigators say, was paid more than $40,000 by Artiles to run as a no-party candidate to sway the outcome of the 2020 Miami-Dade Senate District 37 election. Republican State Senator Ileana Garcia won that election by only 32 votes. And Rodriguez has recently taken a plea of guilty and is now cooperating with prosecutors in the ongoing investigation into more campaign finance crimes. Investigators are also looking at $550,000 in untraceable money that paid for misleading political mail advertisements in support of the sham candidates involved in this scheme. The $500,000 in spending, and here's where it comes full circle, the $500,000 in spending was paid for by another dark money group called Grow United. And Dan Newman, a former Democratic consultant and lobbyist at a firm that during his tenure represented FPL, received a $1.25 million check in September 2020 from FPL, from Florida Power and Light, to his consulting firm, which he shared with consultants who were tied to this Grow United, this dark money group, and to the criminal election scheme. Now, Florida Power and Light, according to the Miami Herald, is very nervous that their payments and their involvement in the candidate schemes in the 2020 election are coming to light. They are so concerned that they put up a website to criticize the Herald for the Miami Herald's investigation as biased and a witch hunt. But it seems to me, to quote Andrew Gillum, a hit dog will holler. So, I just wanted to get a sense of whether these disclosures and this investigation by prosecutors in South Florida is having any influence in any way on slowing down these efforts by FPL to control energy policy in the state legislature. Are you getting that sense, Susan?
Wow, there's a lot there to unpack. So let me tell you, money has always been a huge influencer up here and in this process. And I mentioned before, I've been in watching the process really close up probably since about 1987. My brother Ron Glickman was a member of the Florida House from Tampa, actually, and I worked with the Miami.
I remember that.
Right. So there's always been money in the process. It did seem, probably in the era in 2009, and you may remember where 8 days left of the session, they tried to lift the ban on drilling on near shore, 10 miles to the shore. And I remember someone coming running up to me and saying, they're going to do this. They're going to lift the ban on nearshore drilling. They've given, this is the gentleman who was the incoming Speaker of the House at the time, named Dean Cannon. Mike Karadopoulos was the incoming President of the Senate. And they said they'd given Dean Cannon $2 million. And I said, $2 million? I'll give him $4 million, not to drill, right? So it just became sharply transactional. And you hear that word a lot up in Tallahassee. So you're
transactional. Well, we have an example of that here, don't we? I mean, we have this group backed by FPL's money giving $10,000 to Senator Jennifer Bradley's PAC, and Senator Jennifer Bradley then proposing this net metering rule adjustment. It seems pretty that seems like a pretty transactional situation.
Well, maybe not. I mean, they all raised money. $10,000 is a really small amount of money. Now, some of the articles that you were reading was a much more significant kind of thing. I mean, it was tens of millions of dollars being, pushed into PACs. And, so,
Let me be fair. In fairness, yeah. I mean, isn't that the expectation of all political donors? I mean, whether you give millions, whether you give $25 or $100 to your favorite candidate, I mean, isn't that the expectation of all political donors that they will get the legislation and the policies that they want in exchange for their financial support? I mean, that's the way the world runs, right?
Yeah, that's traditionally the hope. You know, one thing I wanted to say about money and this net metering is that in 2016, I think you mentioned this earlier, there was an initiative on the ballot, Amendment 1. We call it the Bad Amendment 1. In 2014, the Good Amendment 1, the Land and Water Legacy Amendment passed. But in 2016, the utilities ran this fake, kind of phony ballot initiative. You may remember it got a lot of attention because the James Madison Institute, one of the sort of right-wing think tanks, was bragging about the political jujitsu on the ballot in Florida in 2016, that it sounded like it was good for solar when it was bad. The essence of that, they wanted to put in the state constitution this notion that somehow non-solar customers subsidized solar customers, which is unsubstantiated. It is not true. But they were going to put it in the constitution.
Now,
they spent about $30 million, maybe more, but that's what we know that was reported. So you're talking
And it failed, right?
And it failed. And that's one of the main points. And I hope that listeners, when they're calling their electives, will make that point. Voters rejected that notion by almost 10%. Even though it was a very, kind of duplicitous campaign and tens of billions of dollars, spent in there. So,
yeah, but it does seem, though, that, and I talked about this in my intro, but it does seem, though, that with that failed effort, that FPL and other utilities have turned their attention now not to taking their position directly to the voters, but taking their position and, more importantly, their money to the electeds in Tallahassee.
Well, and it's a smaller group of people. And
which, of course.
The smaller group is the Florida Public Service Commission, right? And so that's what they're doing in this bill. It would go back to the Florida Public Service Commission to redraft the rule.
Right. Let me bring in, we have a text message from Charlie Behrens who says, solar net metering has proven time and again in dozens of scientific studies around the country that it is beneficial to the community. In fact, it is really underpaying rooftop solar owners for the electricity that they are supplying to their neighborhood. If anything, FPL and the other monopoly electric companies should be increasing net metering rates. Now, I want to, at this point, bring in another guest to join us with Susan. Susan, if you can stay on with us. My next guest is C. Rudy Engholm, who's a retired lawyer and a solar pioneer in Florida and elsewhere, who's been following the fight over net metering very closely. In fact, Rudy is the person who wrote a very compelling op-ed piece in the Tampa Bay Times recently praising the net metering policy as a net positive for Florida and one that should not be weakened. So welcome, Rudy, and please tell us a little bit about your background as a solar energy pioneer and why you advocate for this net metering rule in Florida. You with us?
Thank you, Shelley. I'm glad to be here.
Appreciate All right, it. Just speak up so we can hear you clearly.
Okay. Thank you. I come at this from a very different direction than Susan does. I first put a solar system on a house back in the 1990s when essentially nobody was doing it or it was a very non-mainstream thing, and lived in Maine at that time off the grid for 10 years. Following that, we put in a solar system in a house in southern Maine near Portland, tied to the grid. I live in Lake Wales now, have for several years. We have a solar system and are shortly going to be moving to a renovated home and putting in my fourth solar system. So that was really the genesis of why I got interested in this whole topic.
When was your op-ed published, Rudy, in case people want to read it?
It was the December 23rd edition of the Tampa Bay Times. And the title of the op-ed was "The Florida Legislature Could Send the Cost of Solar Through the Roof." And if you don't mind, I'd like to sort of give a perspective on this whole net metering issue. First of all, the fight is not just in Florida. This is a nationwide issue that investor-owned utilities have been pushing for changes in a number of states. California right now is on the cusp of some changes. And the whole assumption underlying the bills that have been introduced in the Florida legislature, this SB 1024 and its companion bill in the House, is that somehow poor people are subsidizing wealthy solar owners, and that's, they call it cross-subsidy. And the bill directs the Public Service Commission to change the net metering rules. Now, it doesn't tell them to simply investigate whether they're working or not and whether they ought to be changed. It's really an attempt to rig the game in advance. It's like
So you support Susan's suggestion that what's needed is a study to determine the efficacy and I guess the financial consequences of net metering.
Absolutely. Florida does not have or has not had such a study. Now, studies like that have been done in, I'm aware of, at least 40 or 50 in other states. And let me give you a brief example of why such a study is needed and then what kind of study is needed. But let me start with this. Susan quoted that old saying, you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I start with the point, why are the Florida investor-owned utilities, and FPL in particular, pushing for these changes right now? Change suggested is that the legislature finds, it's actually in the law, it's a finding, that essentially low-income people are subsidizing wealthy rooftop solar owners. That is an untested assumption, but that is the core of the legislation. The only way you can really know if that's true is to do a credible study of whether, you know, the power. Well, let me give you an example.
Well, hold up a minute. That is the one argument that they're making that has a certain appeal to legislators, I would imagine, like Democrats, like Daryl Roussan, for example. That's not necessarily the truth of or a factual statement. It's an argument, right, Susan?
Yeah, that's correct, and it's actually unsubstantiated and not true. What hurts all ratepayers, all customers, particularly low income, is when you build a power plant, that's what makes your bill go up. That's what's in these big, giant rate increases. On the other hand, solar actually saves money. And I give you an example. The Great Bay Distributor in Pinellas, the biggest Anheuser-Busch distributor in the state, about 6 years ago got solar. And I say that because it's a lot less expensive now. They put it on a cold storage facility, a megawatt and a half, and it paid for itself in 5.15 years, right? So they get 25 years of free electricity. Now, you can understand why utilities don't really like that, right? Because
right.
It makes it harder for them to make money. That's their business model. You referred to that in your opener, Shelley. So we're in agreement. It is way premature. You also need to look at solar, at the value of solar. Because if you think about a centralized power plant, which is the business model, that's usually sort of far away, and then they have to build transmission lines, and you lose energy in the transmission of the energy itself. If I've just got solar on my roof and it is powering my house, you know, it's got a higher value. And we still don't put a value on the externalities like things like air pollution, you know, and all the health aspects of that.
Well, let me ask Rudy to comment on, as a person who uses solar and who has the benefit of net metering, to comment on that.
One of the reasons we got solar, and I think it's the reason most people put rooftop solar on, is they want to take advantage of essentially free fuel from the sun. And you put a certain amount of money into your system. That is, the customer pays for that. This is not a cost being charged to other ratepayers. So I personally paid for a solar system on the roof. Now, that produces a certain amount of power that I consume in the house. And during times of sunshine, typically the middle of the day, that system produces more power than we use. So it gets exported back into the grid. And in Florida, that's particularly valuable power because that's when most of the air conditioning happens in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So we're actually benefiting the grid at that moment. Now, at night, I may use some power from the grid. And really, the only way to know who's subsidizing who is to do a fairly involved study that looks at, you know, who's using the power, when are they using it, who's supplying the power, when are they supplying it, and so forth. Those studies have been done in other states, and almost all of those studies have a finding that says it's the other way around. That is, the people who have rooftop solar are actually subsidizing ordinary ratepayers. Let me give an example of the Maine study. In the op-ed, I used a very personal example. I said back in, I think it was 2014 or 2015, there was one particularly hot day in Maine, and we lived at that time within sight of a big oil-fired power plant. And on one particularly hot day, that plant started belching smoke. It was owned by NextEra, which is, I think, the parent
of FPL, the parent company.
They only fired up that plant on days when they were short of power because it was such an expensive polluting plant to operate. I found out later, because I got curious and looked it up, the utility, Central Maine Power, was paying $1 per kilowatt hour at that moment to buy power from that big polluting plant. At that moment, I was being subsidized 13 cents, or I was being paid 13 cents an hour through net metering for my power. So in other words, the ratepayers of Maine at that moment were paying the polluting power plant 7 or 8 times what I was getting for clean power. Now, the problem is it's very hard to make sweeping statements without actually doing an analysis. A good analysis would add up all those kinds of occasions, who's paying whom, when, and so on. What I would argue for are three things. One, we don't need this change right now. We heard at the hearing yesterday a number of individuals with good local solar companies hosting good-paying jobs saying that their companies would essentially be decimated if this change were to come about. Before we decimate one of Florida's best, cleanest, fastest-growing local industries, it seems that the legislature ought to commission a careful study. And a study, in order to be credible, ought to be done by a reputable, nonpartisan third party. There are institutes out there. There's, you know, the Solar Center up at UCF. There's, you know, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science. There's many, many institutions that could do such a study. It ought to clearly state what are the values we're looking at. You know, do we count things like clean air that comes from clean power and so on, or don't we? Secondly, it ought to look at how the methodology and be very public about here's how we're going to do the study. And the third thing the legislature should require is that the data, which is largely in the hands of the utilities now, the data should be made publicly available to any party who wants to authenticate that study.
Okay, hold up for a minute, study, Rudy. These seem to be so eminently reasonable suggestions that I can't believe that in today's political climate, the Republican-controlled Florida legislature would accept them. Now, you know, Susan, you've been up there for a long time. You, too, have championed the idea of a study along the lines of that which Rudy is suggesting. But in our political climate today, what do you think the odds are of being able to persuade the legislature that that's what we need right now?
Well, I think that if everyone listening, and all across the state, is calling their lawmakers and there are others like Jackie Polito and James Buchanan that are Tampa Bay that will get this in other committees on the House side. If there's enough noise out there and with all the pressure going on, because some of the things you referred to earlier, some of the bad press create pressure in the legislature, they might aim to a study. I mean, if left to their own devices, they're going to do what the big donors, you know, tell them to do or ask them to do, right? That is, you know, what we see consistently. So I couldn't agree more. People just need to make a ton of noise. You know, go to your lawmaker's office and just say enough is enough. And whether your issue is, you know, sort of the, you know, fairness for people and energy freedom, or it's jobs, or you're concerned about climate change. Remember, too, we let the polluters pollute for free, essentially. So anyone that is burning gas, fossil gas, like Duke or Tampa Electric or Florida Power and Light, they are polluting. They're putting greenhouse gas emissions. We're all paying for it. And even the Florida legislature has acknowledged that. That's why they're putting hundreds of millions of dollars into adapting to climate change. So we're all feeling the heat and we're paying the price. So that's what Cecil was sort of getting at. If you do a real value of solar analysis, then we can see, you know, at what point, you know, does there need to be, you know, fair amount of charges? But it needs.
I have noticed, though, that in today's political climate, the last thing that Republicans seem to want is to have facts and to face facts and to have science. And have the scientific method establish certain facts that would be inconvenient to the policy positions they want to champion. I mean, that's just my perspective. Maybe other people see it differently. I don't know. Rudy, what do you think? I mean, do you think that there's a chance for people who are, like you, advocates for solar power, being able to persuade the Florida legislature that they need to do this?
Well, let me reply this way. Back in 2017, my neighbor in Lake Wales and I did a joint op-ed that was published in the Tampa paper. I originally wanted to call it Red Solar, Blue Solar, but the paper picked a different name. And essentially, it gave reasons why a very conservative, a person with a conservative political outlook should like solar. It's self-reliance. It's efficiency. It's made in America jobs. It's local control. It's property rights. All those things are embedded in putting solar and your own power on your own roof. If you come from a different persuasion, you might say, I care about clean air and climate change and public good and, you know, benefiting all ratepayers and so forth. But the point is that solar is actually highly popular all across the spectrum. I mean, you can look at, you know, prepper websites.
Yeah, prepper websites, self-sufficiency. Right.
Which have a particular political bent generally. You know, self-sufficiency is one of the great values. So that's why I'm confident that if people are aware of the stuff that's going on, regardless of their political persuasion, it just simply makes sense. It makes sense to your wallet. It makes sense to your neighbor. It makes sense to yourself.
All right. We've only got 2 minutes left. Okay. So I want to ask you, Rudy, before I let you go, if people want to learn more about solar and this perspective on net metering, where can they look?
There are lots of articles about it.
Let me ask Susan, too. Susan, if people want to keep track on this, where can they look for information? We've only got a few minutes here, a couple minutes, actually. So give me a place to send people.
Yes. In fact, my colleague, George Cavros at cleanenergy.org at the blog, just did a terrific blog that comprehensively sort of lays all of this out and sends you to an action alert. And there's
what is it called?
Work. So, yeah, cleanenergy.org.
Okay.
And hit the blogs, and you'll see a blog there from my colleague, George Cavros. And that lays it out, and it'll send people to where they can take an action alert. So there's still time. In 2016, it was a coalition of right, left, of Greenpeace and the Tea Party that stood up together, has been said here. This is not a Republican issue or a Democrat issue. This is an issue about energy freedom.
All right. I've got to cut you off now. Thank you. That's all we have time for today. But I want to thank you to my guests, Susan Glickman, the Florida Director of Clinicians for Climate Action, and Rudy Engholm, who's a solar pioneer and advocate for solar energy. I want to thank you, Lamar Robinson, for our sound, and Frank Knox for answering our phones. As always, thank you to the listener supporters of WMNF Radio who bring you this show. Please stay tuned for Duncan Strauss and Talking Animals next. This is WMNF Tampa.